Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Inclusion First Podcast. My name is Carrie Sawyer and I am your host. I'm excited. You know, I'm always excited to have these incredible conversations with these amazing people who are really just walking in everyday activism, everyday anti-racism, doing that thing that they can do from the place that they are. And today we are going to get to talk to a new friend, and her name is Rebecca Wiggins. And Rebecca describes herself as a kitchen table activist who comes from a long line of kitchen table activism. This activist spirit has taken her to homeless shelters and youth mentoring programs, and it motivated her doctoral research. For Rebecca, activism is about the bent of your heart and mind towards justice and mercy. Rebecca and I crossed paths very serendipitously, and she was like the perfect person to come into my life at the exact perfect time. She is smart, she is good humored, she is very talented, and I am excited to jump into this conversation today. Please join me in welcoming Rebecca Wiggins to the Inclusion First Podcast. Hello, hello. Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. We have another amazing guest on today, my friend Rebecca Wiggins. Rebecca, how are you today? Welcome to the podcast.
I am really excellent, and I'm very excited to be talking with you.
I'm excited to talk with you too. So Rebecca, tell everyone a little bit about yourself, and then we will jump right into the questions.
Very cool. So I consider myself to be a kitchen table activist. I think I put that in my bio to you. And by that, I mean, I'm a person who has been involved with activism at a very like home level, you know, not major big organizations, not big events, but it's been a part of my daily life on many levels, even since I was a child. And we'll talk more about that later, I'm sure. But I am a mom and a professional and an academic and a few other things that I just wear lots of hats. And it's because I have ADHD and I keep having to do lots of new things to keep my energy up and to keep my interest going. Right now, I am about to transition into a business training role, which I'm very excited about, with a startup that is growing exponentially. And as my time with Carrie has shown, I really like doing all the new stuff with the people who haven't done that before. And so I'm really excited about this role.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's always cool to get in on the ground floor and kind of get to shape that organization as it grows. So congratulations on your new gig.
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're actually going to start off by talking about activism. I would love to know, Rebecca, like, what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2022? And do you consider yourself to be one?
So I really thought a lot about this before we got together, because I would have said, if you'd asked me just kind of off the cuff, that I wasn't an activist, because in my mind, that really is the people who are like organizing rallies and doing petition drives and, you know, having big voices on social media and things like that. And I just don't really identify with that role very much. I am pretty introverted. And so I feel like being on the big center stage just is not a comfortable place for me. Okay. And also my work has been really eclectic and in a lot of different venues. And I can't really see this strand of like, oh, I have been doing all this activist work. Like, and so I thought about it and I realized that that wasn't really actually accurate. I don't know that I am an activist with a big A, like this is my vocation. But I do feel like that activism with a small A has been a really important part of my life since I was a kid and a teenager. And I feel like I need to give a little bit of background because it helps me to understand activism and maybe to help give a definition for how I see activism in the world.
Love it. Please.
So I am a person of faith, and my faith is very central to my identity. And it's also central to my activism. And it started with my grandparents, who were really special people. When I was a kid, so I don't know, 8, 9, 10, I remember seeing my grandma sitting at her like little ancient word processor, because I'm old enough to have seen ancient word processors. She probably used a typewriter before I was old enough to know it, writing letters to her congressman to local and state government people, protesting things that she didn't like that they were doing, or advocating for things that she thought was really important. And in particular, my grandparents were Catholic, and they were very adamantly pro-life. And I know that that gets a real bad rap in a lot of circles. And I would say that in part, it's because people equate being pro-life with being anti-abortion. And that's not really how it worked for my grandparents. The way that it worked for them is that they were about how every person has value and every person needs to be seen as valuable. And so when there were issues of life, it wasn't just about abortion, although that was very important to my grandmother, but it was also about homelessness. It was about addiction. It was about people being disconnected from their families. Hold on a second.
Okay, we're in a pandemic. There's babies. Yeah, there's babies, there about babies in the pandemic. Honey, and every other time, too.
Stephen, could you get Margaret, please? Maybe you will get to see Margaret.
I love Margaret. Yes.
So for my grandparents, it was working at homeless shelters. It was helping out at soup kitchens. It was inviting strangers into your home. I was an adult for years before I realized that it was not normal to have family gatherings where there were people there that you did not know. But my grandparents were always taking in strays, as people used to joke. And there was always, you know, lone sailors that didn't have anywhere to go, or somebody from church who didn't have any family. And there were multiple times in my growing up life where my grandparents opened their home and invited single moms who didn't have any place to go, people who were dealing with domestic abuse that needed a safe place, children who were dealing with issues with homelessness, that they would just come and live in my grandparents' guest bedroom. And all of that really shaped, I think, the way that I understood what it means to be an activist, because to be an activist was to open your life up to people and to care about what happened to people, not just the people that you were related to, or not just the people who were like you in life circumstances, but the people who needed you or the people who needed help or care. And so I witnessed all of that growing up, but they also invited me into that. Like, I remember writing letters to my senators when I was like 15 or 16, so I couldn't even vote, telling them about things that I liked or didn't like. And I remember thinking, well, I'm their constituency, even if I didn't vote for them or can't vote for them. Like, they still are supposed to represent me, so I have the right to tell them what I like or don't like about what they're doing. And so so I took that into my early, like into my early 20s, and I really equated activism primarily with, not my baby screaming and crying, but primarily with like political action, right? Participating at rallies, backing political candidates. I did canvassing for third party candidates in the town where I lived, that kind of stuff, and working with people who were local elected officials. And then as I got older, I got a little disenchanted with that. I think in part it was because I knew so many people who were really politically active, but they didn't necessarily care about the people that their actions were supposed to impact. And that disconnect between the caring that I grew up knowing as being an essential part of activism and the action that people were taking was really, there was a lot of like cognitive dissonance for me, and I just didn't know what to do with that. So I stepped back from all of that, and I was like, I am not interested in politics anymore. I'm not interested in getting involved in any of those things. And it also cut into some of my more personal interactions with people, you know, being involved in volunteer activities and stuff like that, because it was hard for me to disentangle my disenchantment with political activism and my work in community organizations and things like that. And I realized that I kind of got disconnected from those kinds of things. I had to put a lot more effort into my art, and I was spending a lot of time doing that. And there was a lot of my ideas about the way that people are and the way that the world is in the art that I was making, but I still didn't connect that very much with what was going on or with the identity at all of being an activist. And then I went to college when I was 25. So I had a business doing custom sewing out of high school, and I was doing a lot of art stuff and teaching art classes, but I decided when I was 25 that I wanted to go to college. And I went to this school called Berea College in Kentucky. And this actually had a really formative role in helping my understanding of my activism. It's a work college that was started by a man named John G. Fee in order to create the first co-educational interracial educational institution in the South. And this was in the 1850s. And it was a planned community. When they first built the town, every other house was a black family and a white family, black family, white family, because John G. Fee believed that if people knew each other, then that would end a lot of the racial stereotyping and violence and broken community that he saw. And so, obviously, you know, things evolve, things happen. The state of Kentucky actually passed laws to segregate that Berea College, to force them to segregate in the early 1900s. They created laws that were only existent in order to segregate Berea.
Wow.
And so their mission has evolved to be not just about race, but also to be about poverty. And they educate more people who come from backgrounds where nobody has been to college, first generation students, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so some of that is about people in racial situations where they've been blocked out of education, and some of it's just poverty and rural people and stuff like that. So when I went to Berea, I got really involved with the International Center students and all of the issues there. There were a lot of Tibetan students there because they are nationless, and it's hard for them to get into schools because they don't have a national identity card.
Yeah, and so paperwork.
Paperwork and bureaucracy. And so Berea had a very special relationship with the Dalai Lama and was able to take in a larger number of Tibetan students than most schools could. So that was a big population. Yeah, kind of a random sort of thing. And they also had the largest population of African American students in a private school that is not an HBCU.
Right. Wow.
So that meant that there was also a lot of that very specific black and white interracial education going on. And one of the things that really made it work is it's a work school and you have to be below a certain income to even get in. So there was kind of this like really functional socialism where everybody was broke. So it took out a lot of that competition to have, you know, better clothes and bigger cars and that kind of stuff. And people could meet on a level where they were about their shared interests and shared experiences, or creating shared interests and shared experiences. I actually was an active member of the Black Student Union. And if any of you have seen my picture, you will realize that I am definitely not a person of color. President was a really good friend of mine, and he invited my best friend and I to be a part of it because he felt like the Black Student Union was more powerful when it had more allies. Mm. And I think we're going to talk about allyship a little bit later. But that was something that it changed a little bit of my perspective, because what I realized is there is this part of activism that is just about relationships. Right? Who you choose to invite into your life, who chooses to invite you into your life, and how much you choose to invest in knowing them and caring for them. And then by extension, learning to know and care about their community and the people that they know and love and care about. And one of the hilarious moments of our time in the Black Student Union was when there was a big event and people were bringing food, and I love to cook, and feeding people is kind of part of my DNA. I don't even remember what I made. It may have been homemade macaroni and cheese, but I brought it and I set it up at the gathering, and people were like, "Oh no, there is no way that a white girl made this." I was like, you know, white people like to eat good food too. And I come from a very food loving family. So, you know, you have to learn how to make those kinds of things at some point or another. But so that's kind of the history of how I got into activism and how that worked. And I would say that in the years since graduating from college, it has overflowed into a lot of areas of my life in the way that I work with community organizations. I've been a member of the Christian Community Development Association for a number of years. They are an organization of people who are involved in community organizing, advocating for the growth of and the health of damaged and marginalized communities. And I have learned so much in that space. One of the things that I have learned at a relatively young age as a white woman is that it's really important to embrace the humility that's required to learn from people who are not like me. Mm-hmm. And that, but that it's very easy for me to avoid ever having to be accountable to somebody who is not like me, or ever having to learn from somebody who's not like me. And so I have to be intentional about putting myself in spaces where I allow my, well, I seek out mentors whose experiences are different than mine, and that I allow them to help me to see my biases and help me to see my, my blind spots, and also to recognize the validity of their experience and the importance of understanding it, but also of elevating those voices and helping people to understand, other people around me to understand the necessity of understanding those experiences and hearing those voices. And all that was really helpful because at the ripe old age of 39, I finally got married to an African-American man. And
you're not the first black person I ever knew. Yay.
I am not. And I'm not the only black person in my circle of acquaintance, or the only non-white person in my circle of acquaintance, which is, you know, always awkward. But my husband and I have somewhat similar family backgrounds. We come from working class families. So like our economic, socioeconomic background is similar, and that definitely helped us to connect. And our family structure was similar. We're both the oldest of three siblings of intact married parents. You know, our moms were stay-at-home moms. And so there was a lot about those dynamics that were similar that allowed us to relate really well. We both are also very socially awkward and strange and creative. And so we both have often found ourselves marginalized from mainstream expressions of our community. Sure. My husband does not like hip hop. He actually was a techno DJ for years, starting when he was in high school. And so, you know, being a black man and being into techno music was also very awkward for him in the late 90s and the 2000s. He's a printmaker, which means that he makes fine art that nobody understands because it's not drawing and it's not painting.
It's very manual. We're not doing it anymore.
Very hands-on. Very beautiful. Very amazing. Yeah. And so I think that God had really prepared me over the course of my life to recognize the beauty that I see in my husband and his work, and to be able to partner with him in a way that I don't know that I would have if I had always lived in a really white situation or in a place where I was not in regular relationship with people who were not white. But it's been really interesting and very educational to me to have to walk with him through all of this. We moved to St. Louis in 2018, shortly after we got married, and I have never experienced the kind of fear that I experienced when I had to send my husband to work in a car that did not have a working headlight at night. Because I mean, those of you who are familiar with St. Louis, I mean, that is now infamous for all of the Michael Brown incident, all the riots that came after that, the other racial issues. St. Louis is a very racially divided city. And I used to joke all the time that his safety lied in the fact that he drove a very white girl car. I had a Fiat. And I'm like, nobody's going to expect a grown black man to drive a Fiat. And so that's kind of like this extra layer of protection. But it was almost a surreal experience for me the first time I realized that I was actually deeply and mortally afraid for my husband. Mm. And that this is an experience that women who love black men have experienced all of their lives. Like, there's no time in American history where that's not been the case. And while we always want to work towards making that less of a concern, it is so embedded in the DNA of our culture that I think it's going to be a long time before that's really totally worked out. And so that changed a little bit of my way that I was thinking about activism, experiencing that with Stephen in St. Louis. And then shortly after that, there was, George Floyd and COVID and all that crazy. And we actually did get involved in more political action and protests. It felt like it was really important for us to be in that space. The other thing that changed for me kind of significantly was the way that I thought about church, which, I mean, this is very unique to me as a person of faith. And so this may not be relative to all of your listeners, but I had always previously chosen where I placed the places of worship that I belonged to or the communities I belonged to based upon theology or personality or, like, you know, the kinds of spaces I wanted to live in. And then when we got married and I was talking to my husband about his experience of living as a Black man in predominantly white evangelical Christian spaces and how isolating that was and alienating it was, and how much he had to persevere in his faith individually because he got so little support and recognition from the communities that he was a part of. And so when we moved together to St. Louis, it was really important for us to choose a community to worship with where he was going to be sitting under leadership that was like him. And that's not easy to find, just generally speaking. I mean, we wanted to be a part of a church that valued inclusion. So not necessarily just a straight up African-American Christian church. The church that we ended up at had a very mixed, ethnically mixed leadership, including a very large population of Black African community. They had a large French speaking Central African community. And so, there were leaders from that group of people who were also part of the whole church leadership. And it was a really beautiful experience to be able to do that and to be there. And it was fascinating to, as a white woman also, to sit under a Black pastor and to hear him talk about his struggles of being a Black man in St. Louis. He was from there. He also was one of, I think he said like 150 pastors in the denomination that were African American out of a population of like 5,000. Sure. So like they were less than 1%. And what it was like to operate in that space as well. And so it was really a learning experience to me, but St. Louis definitely reactivated my political activist bent. Also the season that we're in, it was very hard for me to watch Donald Trump be elected, and especially for him to make normal really hateful conversations, because I feel like civil discourse was already on a downhill. It was on a downhill slope, but he gave it a giant push into the swamp. and that is, as somebody who loves rhetoric and language and story, that was just really distressing for me and discouraging for me. But yeah, and that brings me to the third thing that has really helped me to realize the need to cultivate an activist understanding, and that is my daughter. I had an interesting conversation with my mom when Stephen and I were dating about getting married and about having children. Yeah, I can't see what's going on in there. They're on the other side of the couch in the living room. But about you know, my concerns and my struggle with the fact that I would not have white children. Not that I had a problem with that, but as much as that, like, there were times that I struggled when Barack Obama was president and everyone was like, oh, look, it's our first Black president. And I don't judge that at all, but he did have a white mother. And it's one of those places, having studied American history and American race history in my graduate work, that the ingrained understanding of the one drop rule is still real.
Sure.
Right? That it doesn't really matter who your parents are. If you have any non-white blood in you, then that means that you are a person of color.
Yeah.
And so so that meant that on a fundamental level, I would always be divided from my children. Mm-hmm. And that even if we had a close, intimate relationship socially, you know, in the eyes of the world, we don't belong together. And it's something that fascinates me because my daughter looks a lot like me. When we were going through pictures, people were like,
she has your nose. Oh my gosh. She does. Like and exact even, nose.
And even her face, like the her shape of her face.
Structure. Her cheekbones are like,
And so when we looked at baby pictures of mine, my sisters were just like, oh my gosh, she looks so much like you.
With your face and brown skin.
Very big curly hair.
Yes, beautiful curly hair.
She's got all of her daddy's curly hair. And so it's been fascinating to me, but it's any white person who loves a person of color and has had to navigate having children with them will tell you that to really love your spouse and your children, you have to think differently about racism, about race, about the way that race works in our communities and in our culture, because it is now completely unavoidable. Like you might have at other seasons in life been able to choose to enter that space and to choose to leave that space. But once the people that you love who make up your heart are living in that space, you also are always living in that space. And so I would say in this season of life, the definition of kitchen table activism is definitely still what defines who I am, because I'm a working mom with a baby. And so there's limited amounts of things that I can like go out and do or that I can give my energy to. But I have found that in this season, for me, activism is really centered around who I choose to be in community with, choosing to put myself in positions of learning from people of color, in supporting people of color who are doing work that I think is important, and making sure that I am cheering them on, but also that I am materially supporting the work that they're doing, if that means financially, if that means emotionally, if that means in acts of service or other kinds of support, that is really important. And I think that because my definition of activism is tied so closely to loving your neighbor and to working for the good of your community, that will never leave. I'm curious to see as our life evolves and as my daughter gets older, if my definitions of activism change. One thing that has changed this season of life is that I have a husband whose art is amazing and beautiful. And sometimes it's about issues of race and culture, and sometimes it's not. But I have found that it's really important for me to champion his art and for me to support his artistic expression, because he lands on the margins of the art world in so many ways.
Right.
He did this really beautiful print called Pick Your Afro. It's just so much fun. I just really love it. And I just love his artwork all the time. Anyways, you'll have to check it out. At Wiggins Artwork is his little tag. He's on Instagram and Etsy and everywhere. But it's actually going to be in a show in Louisville called Art in the Black Experience. And I am really excited, but I realized that I needed to not just promote that to people who already were in the art world or already knew Stephen's art, but I needed to make sure that I shared that with people that I knew who lived in Louisville or who lived in Kentucky, who might never think about going and seeing an art show about the Black experience, because what does that have to speak to them, right?
Sure.
They're not Black, but that I think it's important for people who are not Black or who identify as white to make sure that they are actually doing things that support people of color in the world of the arts in particular, but also that they invite themselves into experiencing a story that is foreign to them, right? People of color spend all their lives listening to, reading, watching stories of people who are not like them. And so it's important for people who are in the dominant culture to make themselves present in spaces where they're looking at stories that are not like them and opening that door. I have to say, I was super excited to look on my LinkedIn feed today and to see that Justice Brown has been confirmed by the Senate. Because when it was, I felt the same way.
We've all been waiting.
Yes. When Kamala Harris was elected vice president, is that every time I see a woman who looks like my daughter, I want to celebrate her. I want Margaret to know that women of color can do all of these things, can be in all these powerful places, that their voices belong there, that it's not just an exception that puts them there. And so anyways, I just had to speak to that, because that is another place where the kitchen table activism comes in, right? It's promoting on social media the things that are important. It's making sure that the people that I love understand my priorities around the representation of people of color. And it's about reminding the people that I love who are not people of color that there's a whole world of experience of people that they love that they need to make space to understand and to know. And in our circle, that is really happens a lot through art and story, because that's the things that Stephen and I do. But that can come in other places as well. So I hope that that's kind of, it was kind of a long story to get us to this point. But yeah, so for me, activism, that's the space where activism happens in the 21st century, in 2022 for me. But I know that that's still growing and evolving.
Yeah. You gave us a lot, Rebecca, and there's so many things that I want to react to. So I'm going to remember them as I kind of go back and think about them. But, you know, I love what you shared about learning first from your grandparents and being in this space and watching them engage in their own political discourse, and then also their own community, you know, discourse and community activism by the support and love that they were showing for different people who may have been on the outskirts, may have been ostracized or, you know, ignored, and really taking them into their home and helping them in the moments that they did help them. But even learning that, hey, you can talk to your political candidates is a great thing to take in at such a young age. And we talk a lot at the Inclusion First Institute about making the change that you can from where you are. And so that was something that really spoke to your grandparents and specifically your grandmother's heart and her interest and the change that she felt, the impact that she could have. And so those were the things that she did. And no one's asking anyone to go out and like start new hobbies or do new things. But in your circle that you're already in, you can find those things. And I think that's a beautiful example of that. Fast forwarding quite a bit, I also really appreciate what you shared about intentionally putting yourself into these environments where there were people who are different from you. And I think that a lot of people from the conversations that I have, they're like, I'm not sure if I belong here, specifically our white allies. Like, oh, I can't go in that store. I'm not sure if I could go to this thing because I'm not that. So I can't be there, or I don't belong, or maybe I'll be rejected or something like that. And this really important point of like, people of color spend their whole life being in spaces where there's no one like them, or there's two people like them, or, you know, we're in these majority spaces, and it doesn't kill you for sure, because we're all here still. And it does help you learn different things, and to be primarily just around people like you. Like, you're only learning certain things about the world, and the world is not like you. There are people who are like you, but there are so many people who are living these really interesting, rich lives. And when you isolate yourself, it doesn't feel like that to you. You're just like, this is just my norm. I hang out with these people, but you're missing out on so much richness and so much beauty. And just that expansion that happens, that when you're in these new situations, you realize how small and how large the world is all at the same time. Right.
Oh, definitely.
So being able to put yourself in those situations and just learn and be open. You're not there to like critique or criticize or judge or validate. You're just a sponge, right? Just taking it in, learning, making mistakes, like making connections, and all of those things. And I think that's really beautiful. And the idea of activism being about those relationships, I think that it is, because it really is all about human connection and repairing the disconnects that have happened between all of us for various reasons. But at the end of the day, like, those things don't feel good. And we just want connection. We want to be able to go anywhere and do anything and have relationships with anyone that we want without these different barriers and constraints and side looks and side glances, right? And that is about connection and acceptance and all of these different things. And I totally see that being a huge part of activism. My brother is married to an amazing woman, and she's white, and my brother is Black. And so, you know, they have interracial children, and just the experience my brother shared with me about, you know, his wife learning alongside him what it's like to walk as a Black person and as a Black man in the world. And, you know, she may have heard these things, she may not have, she may have never experienced them, but seeing things happen to him over 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, 10 years, like, these are very real things to her at this point in time. And she also has, you know, children who are mixed children. And my niece and nephew are very, very fair, but they also have the Sawyer gene, which is super, super strong. And they have curly hair. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, yeah, my partner is like, oh, they look, you know, they look more white. And I'm like, they do have fair skin, but their features are all Black. So anyone that looks at them are going to know, if you're a brown person, you will know that those are mixed children because they look like mixed children. And then of course, my partner is Mexican and I'm Black and we're having a baby. And so thinking about what that will be like. And my partner and I, we were like in bed and we were just like talking about our son and what he's going to be like and what we want to teach him and all these things. And my partner was like, I want to teach him, you know, how to play baseball and wrestle and swim and all these things. And I'm like, and he's like, what do you want to teach him? I'm like, I want to teach him how to love himself and not be a womanizer. That's super deep, super fast. I want to teach him to be a good person. And also, and then we started talking about like, you know, the idea of, you know, I got super political really fast and was just like, you know, all the messages that are coming to him are that men dominate and men are better and women are lesser. And so how do we create a message in our home that tell him that that's not true? And this is actually what is true. We're all created equally with, you know, there's beautiful things about men and women in that relationship. And then that quickly moved over to, and what about what he's going to be told about his race from the outside world? Mm-hmm. And my partner was like, you know, he hadn't really, like, that hadn't clicked in. This is like, you know, we just found out we're having a boy like 2 days before this. So it hadn't clicked in. Yeah, for him. And he's like, you're right. Like, our son is Black. Like, we're having a Black son. And that means something different than even if it was a girl, right? Like, it's a, mm-hmm. there are very similar things, but it's just different as well. And I'm, you know, this is our first child together. I have no idea what it's like to even be a boy. I've witnessed like my brother and my dad's experience, but that's from the outside. And so I'm like, wow, there's all these things. But yeah, my Roman's like, I'm going to, sorry, Roman, I'm telling all your business. He's like, if anyone says anything racist to him, I'm beating him up. I'm like, you know, and the thing is, my partner, he's Mexican, but he also is white passing because his grandpa is from Italy. And so he could be a variety of races and he probably could punch someone and not get arrested for it. Versus if I was with someone who was darker skinned, that wouldn't be okay either, right? And so there's all these layers, all this complexity. When you think about just navigating on your own, but then you add in another person who you love as your partner, and then you have children together and adding in what their experience is gonna be as a mixed person moving through the world with brown skin and brown features. And how do you navigate that? Like, I mean, it's just part of the adventure, but it's complex and complicated and scary and beautiful and challenging. And I don't even know anything about it because I haven't gotten there yet, but I know that it's going to be this like whirlwind of all the things and all the emotions. And you know, you're just there like holding on and hanging on to the love that you have and the vision that you have for the world being better. And then what you can do as a parent, as a person, to make a better way for your child, for yourself, and for the people who come after you as well.
Oh, definitely. And I think that that's something, I mean, Stephen and I talked about that when I was pregnant before we knew the gender of our child. And I'll be honest, like there was a lot that scared me about the possibility of having a boy. Sure. I mean, just watching the people that I loved who had Black boy babies and the struggles that they have. My sister-in-law, my Stephen's sister, she has two sons and they're such beautiful boys. And I think about like sometimes I wonder like, where is that transition that happens between, oh, look at this cute little boy and oh, look at this scary man. Mm-hmm. Like, does it happen when they're 10? Does it happen when they're 13? Does it happen when they're 18? Does it happen when they're 25? Like, but I know that that time is going to come where people are going to look at my beautiful little nephews, Manny and Solomon, and they're going to see them as something threatening and scary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Especially because the men in my husband's family are humongous. Like his brother's 6'9" and Manny, it totally has all the tall genes. And yeah. So like, I just know that.
Type. Yeah.
Yeah, he's gonna be one of those people that people look at, and even if he was white, they would probably be intimidated. But he is a beautiful, warm chocolate brown, and has lots of energy, and is huge already as a 3-year-old. And I just think that it was God's kindness to me because he knew I have, you know, a limited capacity to deal with stress and anxiety at any given time that he started me with a daughter. A daughter who, and this, I was thinking about this when you were talking about your partner, who is relatively ethnically ambiguous. We joke about this all the time, like, yeah. because her hair is curly, but it has a very soft texture, unlike my husband's hair, which is really intense and super curly and much coarser. Like, she looks like maybe she's Latinx or
she
maybe
can be Latina for sure.
Yeah. And I was like, and I'm just like, and I, what's her experience going to be like? Because is she going to have to explain her identity to people? Because people are going to look at her and say, oh, are you X or Y or Z? Because people are always looking for boxes to put people in, help them to understand the world. And she doesn't really fit any very well in any particular boxes. So I think this is having children in a mixed race relationship is just totally a fascinating experience. But one of the things I really love, and we always celebrate Loving Day every year, is the fact that it is becoming much more common and much more normalized for mixed race relationships, whether it's Black and white or Latinx and Black or white and Asian or whatever. Like, those relationships are becoming much more normal. And that's beautiful because the more rainbow our children become, the more likely it is that they will be able to start breaking down those really rigid stereotypes that rely on very specific identifiers.
Yep.
And that's going to be with language and culture and appearance. And I'm really excited about that. I long time ago, I heard some comedian, I think he was actually a Southeast Asian comedian, talk about how everyone's going to be brown eventually. Mm-hmm. Because, and you just keep mixing. That's the color that everybody turns out eventually.
Brown, some kind of brown.
Yeah. So I think about that sometimes. Like, well, everybody's getting brown eventually, whether it's our generation or five generations.
We're
from
still
now,
in a transition phase, and that does encourage me too. Of course, I live in San Diego. I actually live really close to a middle school, and if I happen to go outside at the wrong time or drive somewhere, then I get caught in the middle school traffic. But the foot traffic of the little kids, like walking to their homes or bus stops or what have you. And you can't even like count how many brown kids there are because they're just mixed in. And it's not just like, oh, those are black kids or Latina kids. Like these are all mixed children, like all the hair, all the different tones, like it's mixed children and then Indian children and Asian children and some black and some Latino, but it's all mixed together. And you're just like, oh, well, that's actually really cool. It's really cool to see, mm-hmm. because when our kids go to school, it's going to be even more. I mean, and it's going to be more normal. And so instead of making these assumptions and then judging people, like, you know, I have friends who look Latino, but they're not. And people talk Spanish to them and they're like, I can't speak Spanish. And then that person gets mad at them. You're like, I'm not Latino. So I don't know why you're mad that I'm not speaking Spanish. And even if I was, still, that's like a whole nother issue, right? But those assumptions that we make are going to start to break down, because if you keep making assumptions and you're keep being wrong, you stop, you stop making that assumption. And you're like, and even this idea of like, what are you, or where are you from, or what are you made of? Like all these, you know, kind of, they're microaggressions, honestly, because it insinuates that there's something different about you that doesn't belong or that is different, right? But even people asking, where are you from, will start to go away, because you're just going to assume that they're probably from here. Like we always assume, unless someone's different, in quotes, that person's like me, so they're probably from the same place as I was. I was talking with someone and I was interviewing yesterday. She has a friend who's African and English. She's from London. And then, you know, people assume she's African-American because of the way that she looks and the fact that she's here. But she's not. She's like, I'm not African-American because I'm not American. I'm of African descent and I'm from London. but maybe she doesn't want to always have to get into that. And I think we'll probably start relating to people and connecting in a different way, because that's not going to be a relevant question. And we're going to get tired of like getting our hand slapped from, like, you know, asking something that ultimately doesn't matter. And you didn't want to listen to the long answer anyways. You're like, well, my dad's this, and then my mom's this and this. So I'm this. Like, they're like, well, never mind. How's the weather?
Complicated. Yeah. I didn't think I wanted to know all that. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This has been really fantastic. We totally went on a different tangent. But I love it anyway. So as Margaret gets older, you know, because one of the things that Black families have to do is talk to their kids about race. And it happens typically way earlier than the parents had wanted because of something that happens. As a white woman with a mixed child married to a Black man, like, what is that? What do you expect that conversation to be like around race? When Margaret starts to ask questions that start to like kind of pick at who she is, and like, oh, I noticed mommy looks like this and daddy looks like this. Like my niece is 7 now, and my brother has talked about how she hasn't come out and asked like direct questions, but she asks around the question. She was very disturbed by everything that was happening in 2020, because what she realized was that her dad was Black and this bad thing happened to this other man who was Black. And so something bad might happen to her dad. And so she kind of asked this question that hinted at this like fear and knowledge. And they hadn't talked about, you know, like the really nuts and bolts of identity outside of, you know, you're this and this because we're this, right? So what are you, I don't know, like, and I'm taking that.
honestly, I don't know exactly what's going to happen there. Although I will say that one of the ways that we have kind of prepared ourselves for this conversation is a resource that I want to recommend to your listeners. And that is, there's a bookstore in St. Louis called I See Me. It's EYE, I See Me. And it is all books about the non-white experience, right? It's everything from board books for babies through writings for adults, you know, novels and nonfiction. And their entire premise is that they wanted to show people and give them the opportunity to read stories and to see characters that look like them and sound like them. They have some of the most beautiful picture books that are like retellings of traditional story of fairy tales from different cultural backgrounds. It's not just the store owners are African American and they serve a primarily African American population, but they have been intentional to give an inventory of books around people of color in all different backgrounds, and also particularly of Muslim experience, because they know that that's an isolating minority in the United States. But we actually were in there when we lived in St. Louis. We were in the bookstore with my in-laws, and they wanted to get something for Margaret when she was like teeny tiny. And we found a book called Mixed Me. And it's a story about a child who has a black father and a white mother, and about the questions that people ask about their hair and about like, why do they look the way that they do? And we had already gotten some books that were more strictly about like African American experience that showed black dads with their children. There's a whole series of Lola books. That's a little girl doing things with her dad. And we started reading those to Margaret when she was still in utero. And because we wanted her, that to be normal to her. But one of the things that we did was to pick stories like that so that we're reading them to her and she's looking at the pictures and we're talking about those things so that on one hand, it normalizes the interracial relationship and helps her to recognize that who she is not weird or strange or wrong. But also because the story really does actually talk about some of those really awkward things, like what do you do when people want to touch your hair, and what do you do when people ask you why you don't look like your mom or you don't look like your dad, because she doesn't necessarily look like either of us. My husband is a very dark-skinned black man and I am a very white girl, and so she definitely falls in the middle of that melanin spectrum. And so for me, as somebody who loves stories, that I feel like that's really helpful, because we do understand the world through stories. And so I'm hoping that having access to those stories and having those kinds of conversations around those stories will help make it easier to have those conversations when life brings awkward experiences. But I'll be honest, I really do lean a lot on my husband to understand that experience and to help to have those conversations, because he's lived in majority white spaces for so much of his life as a child and a student, in church and in other contexts. And so he has had to deal with all of those really awkward conversations, having people say things, having people do things. And I also have learned to start leaning on, I feel like that sounds kind of negative, but partnering with maybe is better, with my sister-in-law, and helping to learn more about her experience as a black woman. We've had conversations about Margaret's hair and about recommendations she has around that, and conversations about, you know, her growing up experience and what it was like for her as a girl and a woman, because she knows more about that experience than I ever will. Yeah. And she's someone that I love, and she's somebody who loves Margaret. And I think this kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, right? Where if you are a white person in relationship with a non-white person, you have to be willing to put yourself in situations where you can learn from people who are farther along the road than you are and who have this experience that you don't have, right? I will never understand what it means to take hours to do your hair. I have the world's most boring white girl hair. The only thing that makes it exciting is I have 5 cowlicks, so nothing ever lays flat. But like, I literally could go take a shower, you know, dry off my hair with a towel and go do life, and it wouldn't matter. My hair would look the same as if I did spend a lot of time. My sister-in-law, on the other hand, has the Wiggins massive hair, like just millions of hair follicles per square inch, and all of those hair follicles have a life of their own. And so when she wants to do something, anything that involves leaving her house, she has to really be strategic about her hair. Like, I remember being at her house after her first son was born, and she and her husband were finally going to be able to go on a date because the family was there. We could watch Manny. It would be great. And it took her like an hour and a half to do her hair, because she like would do part of her hair and then she would go and do something else. And she would get ready. She would make some food. She would feed the baby. Then she would do part of her hair. And I was like, I don't even have a clue what that experience is like. Sure. Because I tend to be low maintenance anyways, but that literally is completely foreign. And so being able to sit down and have honest conversations with, like, how can I love my daughter by learning how to care for her hair in a way that's meaningful? And how can I love my daughter by helping her to cultivate a relationship with you as her auntie, who can help her to navigate what it means to be a woman of color in the world in a way that I just never can. And it was very humbling to me to realize how much I needed her in my life as this person who loves my daughter and who can help her to navigate this experience in a way that I, as her mother, have no access to.
Sure. Yeah. I love the word that you use, and you used it earlier, like humbling. And it's one of those things where if you're open and aware, like, there really is no other way to do this. You can try to do it on your own, but at that point you're disadvantaging both yourself for being able to learn more and expand, but also the care and the love and the opportunity for your child. You want to learn, do everything that you can for your children, I would imagine. And so this is it's a small thing. It's a small thing. And if you have access, then you take it, because it's just part of, I love the way that you said it, it's part of loving her. Loving your daughter is by cultivating this other relationship where that gives Margaret access to these things that she needs that you can't give her, and being humble and also aware enough to create those bridges from the moment that you realize it, versus holding on to something else and maybe keeping separate, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I love it. Rebecca, this has been fantastic. I so appreciate you taking the time and giving us all that you gave. You gave so much. You gave us so much to think about and to mull over. You know, I have more questions, and I'm so glad that we're friends and that I will get to ping you and listen to you as you can drop wisdom on you know, being ahead of me in this interracial child game that we're in. Interracial child game.
Oh, yes. We need each other. Well, mamas need each other under all circumstances. Yes. But definitely when there are social obstacles and barriers that you're trying to navigate, that it's helpful to have other people who are doing the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Rebecca, can you let us know where we can find you if we want to, like, follow you, follow your story? And then also, we'd love to get your husband's art handles again too, because we definitely want to use this space to shout him out as well.
Cool. So I have sort of a love-hate relationship with social media. So my main social media presence is actually on LinkedIn. So Rebecca Wolfberger Wiggins, that's me. It's the same, probably the same headshot that I gave you for this. And I'm also on Instagram at Domestic Intellectual, because I like all the things bookish and homish. You'll recognize, I'm sure, at some point, all the pictures of Margaret. My husband, his name is Stephen Wiggins, and his handle is Wiggins Artwork. Pretty straightforward. He's really active on Instagram, pretty active on Facebook and other forms of social media, and he has a website and an Etsy shop. He does a lot of shows in Kentucky and Missouri, and because that's where we lived and that's where we have connections. But he also has his artwork all over the country. So if you see it, great. I hope you can enjoy it. He does all kinds of fun stuff. He really is the king of puns. He has an entire series of battling stereotypes, and it's literally like a stereo, like Magnavox I think it was Magnavox. One of them is Magnavox and Sony. One of them is one of those old school, like 30s big round stoves with a like 50s transistor radio and stuff like that. So he does kind of stuff like that. He's also been working on a series of hair prints. Pick Your Afro was one of them, but there's a whole series. I think it's the Amansunzu tribe in Africa that have very architectural hair designs that look almost like hats and things. And he's done a whole series of prints of those. Right now he's working on sneakers. A set of shoe prints. He also started printing recently with Legos, so he's been doing some really fun stuff with that. He did some Black History Month quotes this year and last year, some silk screens that he's been working on. So I do encourage you to check it out. He also has some totally non-political, non-punny, just art, just doing things that he loves, making beautiful work and hilarious work and stuff that will make people think.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here today, Rebecca. This was amazing.
I love it. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast.
We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to theinclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.